Welcome back to another episode of the How To Fitness Podcast. I'm Kate Lyman.
And I'm Michael Ujoa.
And I don't know what we're talking about today, because this is your deep dive.
Yes, it's always, I always enjoy not running, I enjoy running the deep dive, don't get me wrong, but I always enjoy not running it because you just like, you chill out, you put your feet up and the other person does all the hard work. It's great.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's exactly how it's been. And I'm like coming off of doing mine, you know, it's a lot of hard work to round up all the info and to synthesize and everything. And I like it, but also it's nice to just show up and be like, what are we talking about today?
And let's, you had a late night, Kate, so you just get to chill, catch up.
Right. We had our first babysitter night, you know, without baby going out. It was very fun. I am very tired, but what's new? Worth it. Totally worth it.
Yeah, completely. And you're looking fresh, so you wouldn't be able to tell. Right. So today we are talking about the history of dieting. I thought this would be a really cool topic to delve into, just to kind of see why the diet industry is the way that it is now. But there's a lot. So trying to condense this down into one podcast episode, very difficult. So just like a slight disclaimer there, like I don't cover every single aspect of the history of dieting, because this episode will be about 4 hours long, if not more. I also did just want to do a quick disclaimer as well, that we do talk about kind of dieting, eating disorders, disordered eating behaviors that might be triggering for some people. So I just wanted to kind of make that aware to the listeners before we started. So if for whatever reason you're not comfortable with that, maybe this episode isn't for you. But I'm hoping that we can kind of keep it, even though it's quite a serious topic, because some of these things we talk about are pretty awful, we're going to try and make them lighthearted so that it's not a really intense episode. So I hope I do that justice. And I'm excited to delve into this a little bit deeper.
Let's do it. I mean, this is so fascinating because I can think, okay, 30 years I have been on this earth. Let's call 20 of them being pretty conscious of how people eat and speak about food and such. And the way in just 20 years I have seen, you know, obviously since 10 years old, I've been like that conscious of what's going on, but like trends change and what's important change. And then especially like the last maybe 15 years since high school, like that is significant. And so to think about that extrapolated across, you know, hundreds of years, like this is a lot to talk about. Help.
Yeah, there is. So I, with this history of dieting, I've brought this up until kind of like the early mid 90s, because after that it is just diet after diet after diet, and that's not going to be very interesting for people to learn about. I'm just going to dive straight in and kick things off. So Americans spend over $78 billion on weight reduction services and goods annually, and it's estimated that the average UK adult will spend more than £20,000 trying to lose weight and get healthy over a lifetime. And that is a lot. And these estimations aside, we can only imagine how much time is spent researching and thinking about dieting and weight loss services and the products on a daily basis. So today we're going to unravel the world of dieting. How did it start? What popularized it? And why are we, as modern humans with so much knowledge at our disposal, stuck in the grasp of dieting culture? So I guess this should be quite a good point, Kate, for me to ask you, what diets have you tried? Are you happy to admit if you've tried any fad diets in the past?
I am not happy to admit it, but I can. But yes. So, you know, growing up, I was a vegetarian, and that was a decision made at age 9 because I felt sad about animals. So that was not like a diet, like diet minded, right? Yeah. It's a story, but whatever.
Wait, we need the story. Please tell us the story.
Okay, so my family, we were driving to Mexico. We lived in California, right? We're driving to Mexico to go surfing for a week or so, like camping, surfing, et cetera. And at one point, car broke down on the side of the road, and it was near a slaughterhouse. We're kind of outside of LA, and there's a lot of like meat farms around that area. With my best friend and her family, like family friends, and you know, same age, and we saw it and smelled it, and that was that. Like, we were like, we are never eating meat again. And so for like 11 years, I was a vegetarian from that moment, and pretty strictly so, eventually kind of pescatarian. But yeah, like it really stuck for me. Obviously, it was like a really it was a really, you know, notable event for me. But
so when you said we, is did anyone else in the car become a vegetarian as well?
Yes, everyone, actually. Everyone in both cars, both families.
Wow. Became a
vegetarian. And I don't know that everyone was also like on the same wavelength that my friend and I were on. But I think my mom already was a vegetarian. Context, we were living in San Francisco in the early 2000s. I think everyone was vegetarian. So
that's what, so
it's a fad. It was part of kind of a fad at the time, I believe. And to talk about then dieting, like I think maybe that created this type of idea that like maybe your nutrition had to be labeled. Like I wouldn't be surprised if I'm like, if I felt like, okay, this is like a label for how I eat. Because, you know, going into high school, I did paleo and then zone. And then college, I did paleo again and then keto. I'm not too ashamed to admit. And I did all of that as a vegetarian. And if you know anything about paleo or keto, it makes no sense to do those as a vegetarian. They're like very animal product based. So
you've basically tried them all. Okay. That's
basically tried it all.
I can kind of get that. So I'm also, I know we're going slightly off on a tangent here. How do you approach eating animals when you're feeding a kid? Because this is something that I have thought about with kind of weaning our son, Jude. We've not fed him. Actually, we have. He's had chicken and stuff. When he starts knowing about the animals, how do you talk to them about that? Do you have any tips? I'm putting you on the spot here, Kate.
I don't know. I haven't even thought that far. I think, so we're in a unique situation now where we like buy chicken from a man in our neighborhood market. And he lives, you know, 30 minutes away and has his own like chicken farm. And I feel pretty confident in knowing where it comes from and that it's his family's farm. That's not like a giant warehouse full of chicken. So maybe I will say that it's, you know, this chicken vendor's chickens and he has a farm where he raises them for us to eat. I don't know. maybe talking about, I don't know. Maybe you should cut this out. I have no idea.
No, I'm keeping it in because I want someone else, whoever's listening to this episode, if you have any tips, I know this will probably mean that we'll get messages from vegetarians and vegans being like, don't give them meat. But if you do have any tips on this, genuinely, I would be intrigued because no idea how to approach it.
No, I think down the road, talking about how we do eat animals sometimes because they have some value, like protein, which is good for our bones and body and muscles. Mm-hmm. But it's not an all the time thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be a tricky topic.
I don't know.
We'll discuss notes when they both hit that at the same time.
Another tangent. Whoops. Lot. Last Sunday, last weekend, we went to like a goodbye breakfast with some friends. And it was at this beautiful outdoor restaurant. And there was like a little animal section around it. Like there was like a little mini farm, basically, and in a garden. And it was beautiful. And you could kind of walk through and see like, oh, these are the herbs that were just on our meals, you know, things like that. And not as like fancy as like a farm to table. It's like just someone's house in Mexico. And okay. It just happened to be that it was like really intimate and nice. And they had so many bunnies. And they were so cute. And they all had cute little names like Horchata or Chia or, you know, whatever. And we had some friends with older kids there, like, you know, toddlers and above. And they let them, you know, take out the bunnies and play with them and such. And it's pretty traditional to hear eat barbacoa on Sundays. And this was a Sunday. And we're eating barbacoa as our dinner. And then we learned that it was rabbit. And all those cute little bunnies were the barbacoa. And I don't know. It was both sad and like, well, they're living pretty well. You know, like they've got this space in their farm and they're playing and they're being pet. And is this better or worse? I don't know.
Wow, that's interesting. So were you like, oh, what is this I'm eating? They're like, oh, it's Brian, the bunny you were just cuddling 10 minutes ago.
No, but I see, like barbacoa is usually goat. And I think someone asked like, is this normal goat? And they were like, it's rabbit. And we were all like, okay. Like the one that my kid is over there cuddling, you know?
That's, I mean, yeah, there's a better connection with the food that you're eating. It's way better than just seeing it in a packet in a supermarket and you don't kind of think about where it comes from, I guess. There we go. There we go. Next episode, exploring Kate's vegetarianism. Right, let's jump back into the diet history. So as far back as we can tell, the Greeks were some of the first to have notable aesthetic preferences. So for the ancient Greeks, a beautiful body was considered to be direct evidence of having a beautiful mind. If you were considered beautiful, then you were automatically a good person. And the Greeks actually had a word for this. Kalos kagathos. I think I'm butchering that. However, I apologize to any Greek people listening. And it meant gorgeous to look at, insinuating a good person. For men, the body ideal was pretty similar to today's body ideal, strong and muscular. Ancient Greek females also had body ideals to follow, softly shapen with rounded buttocks, long wavy hair and a gentle face. In a time where many lived in poverty, to be larger and to carry extra body fat on your body showed that you had wealth and could afford to eat to your satisfaction. I digress. So what is a diet? The word actually comes from the Greek word diata, which means way of life. And how far have we moved from this true meaning of the word with today's diet culture? Fad diet obsession within fitness. But here is a more modern definition, a special course of food to which a person restricts themselves either to lose weight or for medical reasons. And this sounds a bit more like what we are used to hearing today.
So here's my take has been like a diet, not diet. Our diet is the way we eat. Sans label. Mm-hmm. Then there's like a diet or to be dieting, which is kind of like a labeled specific term, but this is saying that the definition of diet is like your restrictive way of eating. Is that right?
Yes, that's kind of what today's definition of it is. But yeah, originally it was general way of life. So it just kind of shows how much kind of what we eat was more than just the calories and macronutrients on a plate. It was kind of the way entirely that we approached food, which is a much kinder, nicer way to look at it. And I like to think it's how we approach nutrition, Kate, in terms of talking about it on this podcast.
And that's the thing. And I was trying to say like, that's that original definition is closer to what I think of the definition being. Mm-hmm. But if it's generally accepted as like, this is your restrictive way of eating, then it doesn't matter what I think because yeah. I'm in the minority, you know?
A little bit. So it's funny you say that because I sometimes will do a post on social media and I'll talk about diet in a caption when I'm talking about the way you eat. And people will assume that I'm talking about a restrictive short period of time or a fad and will get a little bit confused in what I'm saying, which shows that, yeah, the true meaning of it has kind of been completely lost. And now social media has just taken it and run with it. And it's now very awful. Okay, so the early Greeks and Romans is where we're going to start our story today. And if you had a healthy body, the Greeks believed it meant you also had a healthy mind. If your body was as healthy and beautiful as a Greek god, that meant your mind was healthy too. Excess fat was not only unattractive to them, but it was also a sign of mental unbalance. The Greeks were really into their fitness, and those that were wealthy would spend upwards of 8 hours a day exercising. And do you know how they used to exercise, Kate? Naked. There we go. It was naked. So they used to exercise naked. And I believe the word gymnasium, gymnos, means naked. So it's like, oh. It just used to be a place where everyone used to hang out naked and just lift weights. And
I mean, I've seen their sculptures. They did look pretty good.
They did.
They did look really great. They did look like they worked out for 8 hours a day.
Yeah. 8 hours a day though. How are people doing that?
I'm just kidding. I don't know. That doesn't. And like, was this pure aesthetics? Was there functional fitness? Like, what are we talking about? Were they moving rocks?
Fighting bears, everything. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, athletes exercised, trained, and competed nude, a practice said to encourage aesthetic appreciation of the male body and as a tribute to the gods. So clearly they were manipulating food and exercise to achieve a certain look that was deemed more attractive. Then we move from a BC to an AD timestamp. I'm afraid we have religion a little bit to blame here too. There was a belief that starving yourself of food was considered to be holy. There is a name for this type of food restriction and it is anorexia mirabilis or holy anorexia. And I'm just going to grab a quote from a website that kind of summarized it quite nicely. We will link this in the show notes as well. On the surface, women viewed their decision not to eat as a means of rejecting earthly pleasures in favor of a deeper connection to God. This rejection of earthly comforts is called asceticism. Holy anorexics consumed little to no food other than the Eucharist, so they believed that they were symbolically sustained by only the body of Christ. The holy anorexics placed a significant value on the connection between the soul and Christ, and identified largely with the depiction of his crucifixion. Perhaps in emulation of then popular crucifixion imagery that showed an emaciated Christ figure, these women chose to abstain from food as a means to achieve the ultimate goal of asceticism. Suffering like Christ. Holy anorexics perceived pain as a symbol of participation in the suffering of Christ and a means of mediating salvation to the world. Eesh.
No.
Yeah.
No.
I know.
It gives me really bad shivers.
Yeah. And the thought of just kind of living off the Eucharist. So that's my Christianity knowledge is not great, I'm going to be honest. And I'm assuming that was just kind of very, very, very minimal food
right
consumption.
Why?
If yeah. you're just living off that, which I mean, you're not going to be a very healthy, energized, active person if that is all you are consuming.
All of that is a lot. Something that keeps coming up for me is thinking about like this like gendered version of diet too, right? Like, so you rewind back to what we were talking about with the Greeks, and the men are supposed to have no body fat because that's indicative of mental health imbalance, but the women are supposed to be soft and well fed.
But
and
not
so here we have
too
this,
well fed though. Like it's still a very, well yeah, fed. It's like very precise. Yeah.
So there's like already division of beauty standards, which are like, men, you go work out 8 hours a day. Mm-hmm. Women, you sit and be gentle, you know? And then the holy anorexic sound female focused. I mean, no wonder we are where we are today, when as far back as, you know, whatever BC, there's these gendered stereotypes and expectations that are just, you know, really difficult. And you know, the means you have to, and you know, divided by the means you have, because if you have the ability to work out 8 hours or to sit and be gently doing nothing, you probably have wealth and status and things that other people don't have.
So true. It's pretty messed up. Let's put it that way. And this was kind of common practice for a very long period of time. And when looking at the history of dieting, things don't really change for a long period of time now. So I think that this is pretty much the norm for a very, very long period. So then kind of the main kind of significant next section in the history of dieting actually jumps forward through to like the 1500s, which is a very long period of time. And this is kind of when the first significant thing happens in terms of dieting, because it is when the first diet book was released. And this book was called The Art of Living Long. The author was a man named Luigi Cornaro, who, according to multiple sources online, was, quote, an extremely overweight Italian. It's really funny, every time you're reading about these people that wrote these diet books, the internet doesn't talk of them very favorably. There's always like really mean names about them in terms of the way that their bodies look. Yeah, there'll be a few others that I'll bring up as well. But yeah, everything was just like, oh yeah, Luigi Cornaro, extremely overweight Italian guy.
Not author.
Nope,
not
nothing.
Not scientist.
No, just exactly. Overweight guy. Yeah. Overweight guy. So he got tired of being overweight and unable to have sex, that he limited himself to two things a day, 12 ounces of food and 14 ounces of wine. I feel like he's got his priorities right there. The wine just tipped it a little bit higher up on the food scale. And towards the end of his life as well, apparently he only ate egg yolks. There's no kind of greater explanation regarding this about like how he cooked them, whether he had them raw or whatever, but he just only consumed egg yolks, apparently.
But did he live long?
Well, that's the funny thing, because I was reading this and I was like, okay, this guy was not an old man when he died. You are completely wrong. So he lived until he was 98 years old.
In the 1500s.
Yeah, so he was a really old guy in terms of, like, I mean, nowadays, though, he'd be considered an old man. But back then,
it's like triple life expectancy, you know? Because weren't people dying at, like, 30s, 40s, maybe?
I think a lot of them were, yeah. So, I mean, it would have done great wonders for sales of his diet book, because people must have been looking at him like, yes, I'm going to buy this guy's book. But yeah, I think it also, it really emphasizes that genetics plays quite a big part in how long we're going to live, because clearly his diet was not the reason that he was living that long. If he was just living off kind of 12 ounces of food and 14 ounces of wine, it was also a very basic diet of what he was consuming within those 12 ounces of food too. So yeah.
So but how, you know, this is kind of when we're also starting this, or at least as far as we can tell from what you've looked up, this idea that like, well, it worked for me, so it should work for everyone else. Let me write a book about it.
Yeah.
Because this man didn't discover anything specific around whatever he was eating and his wine intake, right? Like he was restricting food intake in general. Egg yolks, don't know how I got to that, but okay. But to like have the idea like, this is working for me, because I'm still alive, I guess it should work for everyone else. That's kind of how we approach diet, is it not? Like,
so true. The like modern day fitness influencers are basically doing what these people did, because nearly every person who I mention, or every book or diet approach I mentioned today, most of them start with this person was very overweight and they lost weight and then decided to sell their approach. And that is kind of the 1500s version of before and after photos, and then going trying to sell your ebook. It's exactly the same methods, just slightly slower by having to go to print.
Wow, I'm surprised and not.
Yeah, it's all quite obvious, unfortunately, of the way that it goes. It's pretty awful. So then, jumping forward a few more years, we have the release of the second ever diet book called The Natural Method of Curing the Diseases of the Body. And I guess this person's got a little bit in common with you, Kate, because it kind of revolves around vegetarianism. This was written by George Chain in 1730, and all descriptions of people, as I mentioned, are pretty awful. And so many sources claim that this doctor, this is all it ever says about him when you try and Google him, it's he was, in quote, grossly fat.
Oh.
Yeah, poor guy. And I know that these people spouted some nonsense, but there's a lot of fat shaming going on. Anyway, once again, I digress. So he went on a diet of milk and vegetables, but the moment he went back to regular foods, he regained all of the weight. Classic. So he became a lifelong vegetarian and wrote that the nervous diseases of man come from confined animals. I cannot find difference between feeding on human flesh or animal flesh. So nutritionally, not the brightest button, but his ethics were pretty sound when it came to like animal welfare. So not all bad. Okay. Yeah.
If anyone could just slap a calorie deficit label on these things, then we'd have a little more clarity, and we could, you know, fast forward a few hundred years and save ourselves some egg yolk and, you know, whatever, cabbage diet or whatever. Comforting for us to know it's the same methods now, you know. Yes, I guess. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, so that was kind of 1730. And then when we moved into kind of the 1800s, things start to really ramp up a little bit. So beauty was considered then to be thin and romantic, which I don't really know what that means, but that was the description of what the ideal image was amongst those times. So throughout this time, a lot of clothing was extremely well fitted. So it didn't leave much room for body weight fluctuations. So if you were in a larger body as well, you were kind of stuffed, because they usually didn't cater for those in larger bodies too. So form-fitting clothing and the fact that a slim figure was the ideal meant that those in larger bodies were fair game to be ridiculed and called immoral. And then there was even one book in 1881, I believe, where the government actually advised arresting and imprisoning fat people. So it just kind of shows that, the fat shaming and dislike of larger bodies has been ingrained for a very, very long time.
So when I think back to, you know, I shared a little bit of, yes, I've done every diet and whatever, and this was in kind of my high school, college years, trying to change my body, feeling like it wasn't what I wanted it to be, feeling uncomfortable, et cetera, assuming that, you know, losing weight or looking thinner or whatever was going to make me feel better. It's pretty clear that that's how we've been feeling about things for a very long time. And like, I'm not surprised. We already know that, right? But to see it written out and to see, you know, kind of the history progress, it's same old, same old. Like, nothing is new here. Nothing is new. There is prejudice against those in larger bodies. There is this perpetual attempt to get smaller. There's shaming around if you do and if you don't. And there is no winning, right?
Yeah.
There's no winning. And that's like what's really upsetting. And hopefully we're going to talk about what we, you know, what do we do about this? But continue on through this really upsetting history.
The methods are still exactly the same today, unfortunately. It's the pursuit of thinness and that's it. You know, there's no emphasis on health at all. So then we kind of come to 1820, and this is when you could argue that this is the first like influencer or kind of celeb person that people looked up to in terms of kind of a body ideal. So enter in Lord Byron. Around the 1820s, he was a poet and leading figure in the Romantic movement. And I'm blaming this guy entirely for the apple cider vinegar craze that is still existing within the dieting world today. I bet you didn't think that his diet recommendations would be on TikTok, right?
A nutrition influencer or a fad diet influencer.
Yeah, it's not good. So he was one of the first diet icons and helped kick off the public's obsession with how perceived people of importance lose weight. He was a bit of a celebrity, and we all know how people love to emulate the looks and behaviors of their favorite celebs. So he had an obsession with maintaining a tiny frame and would often starve himself thin and then binge eat. He would then try to sweat it off under layers of clothing. And he invented the vinegar diet, and he would drink it with water several times a day to help flush off his fat. Sadly, there are many records of women dying from drinking pints of vinegar in imitation of their hero, Lord Byron. So he kind of created the vinegar craze. It's kind of one of the first kind of reported of like a celebrity public figure of having like an eating disorder as well, of kind of restricting food intake, binging. I guess you could argue he maybe invented sweatsuits as well, which are still very popular for people to help them apparently lose body fat, which they don't. And then we move into the 1830s, and we saw the first diet retreat for overweight people. And this was set up by Sylvester Graham. Have you ever had Graham's crackers?
Are these one and the same?
It's the same guy. So the guy that created the Graham's crackers was the first person to set up kind of the first retreat for overweight people. He was a militant vegetarian and despised refined flours. Graham's radical principles drew a strong following of devoted supporters dubbed Grahamites. I feel like we need our own tagline of people that follow this podcast, Kate. We'll brainstorm on that later. Yeah. So, especially after the cholera epidemic of the 1830s, when people's health concerns intensified. During this time, he began to lecture again. He was previously a lecturer as well, albeit widely garnering national attention with his renewed emphasis on temperance, sexual restraint, and meatless consumption. And as a regular speaker with the Philadelphia Temperance Society, Graham lectured on the connection between diet, disease, and hygiene, blaming weakened immune systems on poor eating habits. It's not all bad. Like, kind of bringing it back to a previous episode of ours regarding kind of gut health you're speaking about, there's a link. He did make that link. He did then start a fat camp, so not all good.
Cancel each other out a little bit.
Just a little bit. And though Graham claimed his whole grain and vegetarian diet could help people live to 100, he himself died at 57 at his home in Northampton. So, yeah.
Wait, but he really made Graham crackers?
Yeah, I wasn't joking. This is literally... Yeah, this is the guy that makes Graham crackers. They're still a cracker you can buy today. I'm assuming that they don't condone this, so I don't want everyone to go and like message Graham crackers out of anger. But yeah, it's the same guy.
Are your Graham crackers in the UK like a health thing?
I don't think so, but I think they're just a cracker.
Because ours are most definitely with sugar and refined flour. So I
was going to go down this route, but I thought it kind of moved too far away from what we're talking about. But I, now you brought this up, I will speak about it. So I wonder, because he was part of the temperance movement of kind of like restriction, because mm-hmm. this is to prove that you are kind of, I don't know, committed, closer to God, all these kinds of things, right? And I think it's probably along similar lines of cornflakes, because you know how cornflakes, when they started off, were... they were a food to stop boys from masturbating. This, I'm not making this up. It was so bland that the creator of it, Kellogg, thought that it would stop boys from masturbating because it was a sin. I wonder whether it's the same thing. It's like a very bland, boring food to, I don't know.
It makes a lot of sense. And it would be like, I'm thinking like tack, like those biscuits they eat on a boat, you know, that are just like totally tasteless and whatever.
Yeah.
But world records have changed in my, you know, like the honey made ones that I eat. I think I'm so hung up on this because that has to be one of my like, top favorite foods ever.
Oh, wow. Okay. So
ever, whatever.
So yeah, anyone watching this, listening to this, should I say, like, feel free, like, Google the kind of Kellogg's story in regards to kind of preventing people from masturbating. It's a really interesting and weird story, but it's an important part of history, if you ask me, Kate. Okay, right. Anyway. Yeah, swiftly moving on. So then we move into the Victorian era, where we see a lot of the early manifestations of the diagnosed eating disorders of which people experience today. The young pre-adolescent girls of the Victorian era considered the ability to survive without nourishment as a symbol of sanctity. Some of them possessed the capacity to last for an indefinite period without eating any food. Such girls were referred to as the fasting girls in the Victorian era. Such fasting girls refused to intake food and fast for long periods of time. The fasting of these girls was regarded as a miracle by society, and girls who possessed this special gift of indefinite fast were highly respected and honoured. Between about 1850 and 1900, Victorian anorexia was a form of self-imposed starvation that women practiced in order to look thin and frail. The body ideal for women of the time was Elizabeth Amelia Wittelsbach, Empress of Austria, known as Sisi. Known for her 16-inch waist, she worked all day to keep it. She took long hikes, went horseback riding, and did gymnastics all the time, eating very little and using laxatives and emetics to keep her weight down. Yeah, so Kate's holding her hands up to try and see the size. It's quite small, right? So she was kind of doing all this exercise, eating very little food, taking laxatives, which helps you go to the loo, taking emetics, which they're drugs that induce vomiting as well. And she would spend a lot of her time being sick or pooping, basically. If she gained a pound, she would start fasting. Even with the help of her maids and hairdressers, it would take Cece 3 hours a day to get dressed, with an hour just to lace her into her leather corset. I don't even know where to like comment on that whole section, but it's pretty awful.
What a life. Isn't mm-hmm. your life wonderful because you're so thin and have a 16-inch waist? It sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it's just bizarre, isn't it? Like, once again, it's that kind of the chasing the ideal of thinness, but you're like pooping and making yourself be sick from drugs you're taking. Like, that's just not an existence. That's awful.
I mean, that's like a really, really extreme version of kind of what, I mean, no, I'm sure there's individuals, there are, who, you know, fit into this extreme category, and it's, they have eating disorders, right? And mm-hmm. that is a fact. But then there's those who borderline, you know, with disordered eating tendencies that, you know, make you miserable and are this just perpetual chasing this ideal, but at what cost? It's very upsetting to think about because we can all be happier. That's, you know, we all deserve more. So it's very pathetic.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we kind of move into like the first like mass appeal diet. So in 1860, it was created by an English undertaker called William Banting. A lot of people have probably heard about Banting because I think the diet was quite widely known and still kind of spoken about today as well, actually. He was always trying to lose weight, and he finally lost 50 pounds on a diet he invented himself and went on to publish it in a pamphlet called Letter of Corpulence. The pamphlet sold thousands of copies all over the world, and so many people were on it that the term "I am Banting" meant "I am on a diet." Like, the words were kind of used interchangeably. That's how kind of popular it was.
Wow. What was it?
Yeah. Unlike most diets that were extremely low calories, Banting's diet had lots of calories. It was kind of over 2,800, apparently. It emphasized protein, fat, and vegetables. He advised 5 ounces of meat at breakfast with a small biscuit or dry toast, 5 ounces of fish with vegetables, 1 ounce dry toast and unsweetened fruit for lunch, and 4 ounces meat, 3 ounces fruit, and 1 small glass of wine at dinner. I love that he got the wine in there. You had to avoid root vegetables like potatoes, butter, salmon, pork, milk, sugar, starches, and beer. Dieting was here to stay, and no one with any amount of body fat would ever be safe again from diet doctors, diet foods, and diet cures. So like on the whole, in like if you compare it to kind of diets that came before that, a bit more reasonable. You're not really restricting calorie intake. There's lots of things you can eat, but it did also unnecessarily cut out a lot of things too. Yeah.
I mean, from the things we've heard so far, this is definitely most ideal, right? You've got variety, diversity a little bit. It's weird that it's like kind of low carb, but you can have toast. I don't know.
That's my kind of low carb diet.
Bread still included. But wow. What year was that?
So that was in 1860. Mm. Yeah. So not that long ago, really, if you think about it. I know I like to try and think about us being a very forward-thinking species now in 2023. But like this is, it's actually really recent and practices are still very similar. They've not really progressed at all. Like I've heard diets way weirder and worse than this in like the 2020s, right? So mm-hmm. Yeah. So then we move forward into 1918 and we have our first calorie counting book. So this is the beginning of my fitness pal. I believe the person to blame for the ridiculous 1200 calorie diet recommendation as well. So you kind of see this in social media, a lot of people like lose weight, eat 1200 calorie diet. And this is due to Dr. Lulu Hunt Peters. Her 1918 book, Dieting and Health with Key to the Calories, sold over 2 million copies in 55 editions, declaring that being fat is sinful and self-control is the key to slimness. Dr. Peters suggested a diet of 1200 calories a day for women to be eaten in 100 calorie units. To find your ideal weight, she advised taking the number of inches you are above 5 feet and multiplying it by 5.5. I would love to hear her reasoning for that. Come on, get the calculator out.
But what does that tell you?
So this is to find your ideal weight. So number of inches you are above 5 feet.
Which is 4.
I'm 5'4". Times it by 5.5.
It's 22?
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
What does that mean? What?
Maybe she just had really tall friends and was really bad at maths, you know.
200 calories, I can do that.
Yeah. No, so this was your ideal weight.
Oh, that's your ideal weight. Okay.
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense.
So it doesn't make sense, right? 22. So yeah. So I don't know. Shall I do this too? I sat down and tried to figure this out too, and I was very confused. I guess if you're quite a bit over 5 foot, it kind of the numbers are quite a bit high. It's still awful. It's still not good. But yeah, so this was the first kind of calorie counting focused approach to nutrition. So
I mean, if you're 6 feet, you're still says 66.
So 66 kilo?
That's still ridiculous.
It's still ridiculous.
1.5 pounds.
Yeah, but I don't know. Like, I feel like the whole sentence on here is she declared that being fat is sinful and self-control is the key to slimness. Like, it's straight out of, what's that, like, what was that TV, like, celebrity weight loss program? What was it called? The Biggest Loser? I can imagine Jillian Michaels screaming that at someone.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of the same. Yeah. And that's what we're getting at, right? Like, isn't this all the same? We're just talking about different iterations of the same old.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just like the underpinning of all of this was just being fat is really bad and sinful. Like, this is just the message that just kept coming. And also in 1918, Helena Rubinstein, who owned a large cosmetic company, wrote in her 1918 book, The Art of Beauty, that fat is repulsive, slim and boyish is sexier than womanly. So yeah, it's just pursuit of thinness. That's it. Magazines that reached mass audiences, like Ladies Home Journal, Saturday Evening Post and others, were covered with ads for weight loss cures. Most of them were using things like soaps and body brushes and electric currents to take away your body fat. So all just really bad, awful. And around this time too, men were returning from World War I with pre-rolled cigarettes. And these were advertised as health aids that benefited digestion, but also worked as an appetite suppressant to help people to stay slim. And within the next 10 years, cigarette manufacturers actually started adding amphetamines and other appetite suppressants into their cigarette products too. And then we also saw the popular rise of cinema, and the slim ideal became a bit more ingrained in society too. And it became more socially acceptable to be critical of those in larger bodies. So that's kind of where I left it in terms of the history, just because from this point here, it was like low carb diet, the fasting diet, even though it'd been being done for hundreds of years, like all of these started getting names, like the Atkin diet and then the rise of like Weight Watchers and stuff like that. That's it. I thought I'd leave it there. It's probably safer.
Yeah, and it's just, to me, it seems never ending. Like, we try to like make a little dent in the world about like we can get out of this hamster wheel of constantly dieting and chasing this thin, ideal of perfection and such. But like, can it that make a difference? I don't know. I don't know, because you're up against industry, really, right? Like those numbers that you started this with, like something, something billion dollars.
$78 billion on weight reduction services and goods annually in America. And yeah, in the UK, the average adult will spend £20,000 trying to lose weight.
That one hits harder, that 20,000, because you're thinking per individual. Where that 78 billion number is almost like too large for my brain to comprehend. But that's just like being stuck in the hamster wheel, right? Of like chasing this ideal that if we think back to this history that you've just outlined, those who met the ideal were not doing so hot,
Yeah,
right?
right.
Like you are not doing well.
The people that were being
So,
idolized were clearly very unwell. However, this was like the pinnacle of health and beauty. So we will do whatever we can to achieve that. Even if that means our health going down the toilet in the process. It's pretty awful. So instead of kind of continuing down that route, I thought it would be quite a fun thing, maybe that's the wrong word here, just to like expose the ridiculousness of it all. I found this really cool timeline of just like the beauty standards as they've changed and what was considered like a beautiful body in air quotation marks for women. And it just kind of highlights how ridiculous it is that we're always kind of constantly doing everything we can to change our bodies to fit the society view of beauty, when in fact that's just going to change in a few years' time anyway. It just kind of highlights how ridiculous it all is. And I thought that that might be quite a nice way to end this because, as you said, hopefully we can make a dent and make people realize just how stupid it all is because none of it actually focuses on health and improving our general well-being. So it starts kind of with ancient Egypt, 1292 to 1069 BC. And in this era, the ideal woman is described as slender, narrow shoulders, high waist, and symmetrical face. Ancient Greece, 500 to 300 BC, the ideal woman was plump, full-bodied, light skin. Into Han Dynasty, 206 BC to 2020 AD, slim waist, pale skin, large eyes, small feet. Italian Renaissance, 1400 to 1700, ample bosom, rounded stomach, full hips, fair skin. Just makes me feel a bit sick saying all of these out loud. I'm sorry, Kate. Victorian England, 1837 to 1901, desirably plump, full-figured, cinched waist. Roaring 20s, flat chest, downplayed waist, short bob hairstyle, boyish figure. Golden Age of Hollywood, 1930s to 1950s, curves, hourglass figure, large breasts, slim waist. Swinging 60s, willowy, thin, long, slim legs, adolescent physique. That makes you feel really uncomfortable.
Yeah, and let's talk about like in 20 years, they want you to like have boobs to then not, as if it's something you can actually control or have a way you don't.
It kind of reminds me of I don't know, I feel like the Kardashians have had such a big impact on like modern day beauty standards, and the fact that a lot of them had plastic surgery and then people kind of wanted to emulate their look, and then a lot of the plastic surgery or implants were then removed to achieve another look because the beauty standards had shifted, just kind of highlights how ridiculous this is, that you are just never going to win. And the only way you could keep up is if you have unlimited budget and are willing to put your health at risk in the process. I don't know. It's all bad. It's all really, really bad.
Did you? So it was just this year that that a few headlines came out and it said like, I can't remember to the extent. I'll find it and put it in the show notes. But like, curves are out, heroin chic is back. Like we're calling this heroin chic, right? Like we're talking about willowy, malnourished, straight as a board figure. When the past, I don't know, let's call it like 10 years have been, let's get this huge butt, BBLs galore, we're doing glute stuff in the gym. Like it's in 1 year a headline has come out and said, no, we're changing again. It's not, that's not possible to keep up with. So can we like not try?
Yeah, it's true. Like, next on this list was like supermodel era, and it's all like curvy, tall, toned arms. And then 1990s was heroin chic, and it's like extremely thin, translucent skin, androgynous. And it's, yeah, not good. It continues on. I just really hope that kind of with the rise of intuitive eating, kind of body neutrality, body positivity, like hopefully these things are becoming less kind of polarized. I don't know, maybe I'm being a bit optimistic here, but I like to think that hopefully we can break the cycle of it. Probably not.
Well, what do you think? So, make it okay. I believe that people are going to have aesthetic goals, period. Like, I think the idea of like, hey, no one is going to focus on their body and ever, and everyone's going to be happy. I don't, maybe this is cynical. I don't think that's true. Like, I don't think that's a feasible goal to work towards. I think the goal is be happy in your body that you have. And if you have aesthetic goals, can they be ones that make sense for you and your body, not trying to fit you into some other type of, ideal that is maybe so far from what is feasible for you or something like, can you take your body and work within fueling it well and maybe exercising and lifting or whatever that looks like to get comfy in what your body is, right?
Yeah,
And like,
it's
it's hard because I think we become so polarized where it's like, never talk about, weight loss. That is like always bad. And like, I actually like agree to an extent, but just pretending that no one's ever going to have aesthetic goals is silly to me because it's just not true.
I think it's just human nature a little bit, isn't it? So that there's always going to be an element of that. And yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? Because it's something I think about quite regularly because of just the sphere that we work in, where like I always at the foundation of my exercise approach is like longevity, focusing on my health and feeling good. But then I also have aesthetic goals on top of that. Like I enjoy lifting weights to build muscle because I think, oh, I feel quite confident and think I look quite good when I got a bit of muscle in a t-shirt, right? And I'm like, oh, am I then just adding to the noise of like societal norms of what people have to look like in order to be healthy? And it's a really cool discussion. And I don't think there's a kind of a right or wrong answer. I think it's all about I don't know, just your approach to fitness or health or the way that your body looks being non-judgmental. Is that maybe being oversimplistic?
I think that makes sense. It's like, can we work within the confines of us as individuals? Like, what would make me feel more comfortable? How can I get there in a safe way? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I just think that saying, okay, we have how many thousands of years of patterns of like changing our bodies to meet this ideal thinness that is requiring extreme measures, extreme detriment to our health, is not making sense. And then changing the ideals every decade or so, or at least every generation or so, and having people flip-flop on like which unhealthy way they incorporate, restriction or whatever to get there. Like, instead of saying, let's never do that again. Like, I just don't know that saying like, let's stop these ideals and whatever, but how can we ignore them best we can and like work within what makes us feel a little more comfortable. Because I just think saying, don't ever think about how your body looks isn't going to work. Like, I don't know. I don't know that I could do that because when I lift, like kind of what you're saying, and I get strong and I have muscle, I feel so good and I like how I look the most. So, like, to not have a body ideal, I guess it doesn't have any body ideal, but like any type of aesthetic goal or ideal for me, I don't know that that would make sense for me. And maybe that's a wrong way. Like this is a conversation. So tell me if you're like, oh, I don't know if that's good. I
No,
don't know.
I actually I like that. I do like that approach because I don't think you're going to completely shift away from aesthetic goals. I think we just have to do it, don't we, with the acknowledgement and acceptance that bodies come in all different shapes and sizes naturally. And I think when you take it from that standpoint, it becomes a bit easier to approach rather than just being like big body, bad, unhealthy, lazy, slim body, works hard, really fit and healthy. Like when it's just not the reality at all. I think that like everyone's baseline is different. So I think we just have to work with what we've got. And I think if we had a better understanding of that, it would all feel a little bit friendlier talking about kind of fitness and maybe aesthetic goals alongside it. I don't know.
Well, being a little in tune with our own bodies. So like if we think about male beauty standards, I don't think they've shifted as, at least not like, you know, busty to flat chested in 10 mm-hmm. years. Like there's none of the, none of these like really aggressive shifts. It's probably like a little slower, but you know, if I think back to the really tumultuous time of dieting, I think what I wanted to look like was the people on America's Next Top Model, because that was a show I liked, which is really problematic. That could be a whole episode in itself. But I will never look that way. I will never mm-hmm. have like thigh gap or a waist or whatever, because I'm built differently mm-hmm. with like none of that stuff, right? So chasing this ideal that isn't even physiologically possible drives us to do things that are so unhealthy and frustrating, because we're never going to get there ever. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what I did. I guess I could have in this ideal world, that's air quotes, fake ideal world where you have unlimited budget, I could get ribs removed. Like that's how mm-hmm. I'm going to get a waist. We're going to take my two lower ribs out, and that's the only way it's going to happen. So what if we just focus on what we can actually achieve in a way that feels good for us and is feasible, and we get there through supportive means rather than like breaking ourselves down?
Yeah. I also like that you mentioned the whole kind of difference between men and women throughout history too, because every single kind of history of dieting thing I looked through, it was mostly focused around women, because they have just throughout the decades have been under a lot more pressure. Like the ideal seems to shift a lot quicker and a lot more for women, and it's probably still exactly the same now. I'm not saying men are not under pressure to look a certain way, they absolutely are, and that is really problematic, but it does seem like throughout history it's just, it's been pretty awful towards women. Yeah.
And a lot of those like Greek standards from, you know, thousands of years BC are kind of similar to today.
Yeah. Like muscular, athletic. Yeah. They've not changed that much for blokes in terms of like the body ideal. It's mostly on women. So there we are. History of dieting. It's one of those topics, once again, where we welcome the input of people that listen to this show. Like, I'd love to know what you think about this or about the way that we've approached it. Like, we welcome it. And we'll leave it there, because as I said, this could be a very, very long episode if we keep going.
See you all next week.